All right, well, let's pick up where we left off in the First Samuel. We left off in chapter 14. And just keep this in mind, the latter part of chapter 13, when we were going through it, we had read about how the Philistines had so oppressed and subdued the Israelites, God's people, that it got to the point where nobody in the army or the Jewish forces even had a sword except for Jonathan and King Saul, and everybody else, I guess, was using farm equipment as weapons, as tools against their enemies. And I can't help but think that this is what happens when we begin to forsake God and we begin to disobey Him and begin to defy His laws and forget Him and get to a point where everybody does what's right in their own eyes. And the Bible makes it abundantly clear that God's word is a sword. It's a two-edged sword. And so there really is an application here when you see a situation where virtually all God's people are without a sword. What I'm talking about is you see something in the physical world here that can be applied spiritually. These people are without a sword. They're so oppressed by the Philistines. And, I can't help but think of what Amos said in chapter 8. When God said this about his people because as a form of judgment because they had forsaken him and they turned to other gods and they were living in such gross immorality and just defiance of his laws, God said this in the 8th chapter of Amos. He says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord God, when I will send a famine on the land, not a famine for bread or a thirst for water, but rather for the hearing of the word of the Lord. And people will stagger from sea to sea and from the north even to the east, and they will go to and fro and seek the word of the Lord, but they will not find it." I think that says something today, because look what's happening to us. And you can look at history and look at other nations throughout history. I mean, I can't help but think of like Russia before the 1917 revolution, where the communists took over. They had Christian roots and they were somewhat of a Christian nation, but they pretty well had forsaken God. And then when the communists took over, they confiscated all the Bibles and everything that had to do anything with God, anything with religion, anything at all that about Jesus Christ. And I could see this happening in our own nation. In other words, God is being run out on a rail everywhere we turn. I mean, we ran him out of our schools in 1963, and you can't have the Ten Commandments on the walls. You can't discuss Christ in any kind of public forum. You can't, even at a graduation, you can't so much as say God bless you without somebody having a fit. You can't have a nativity scene without some jackass suing you. I didn't want to get off on some diatribe there, but I can't help but see that when you got a whole army here. At first it was 3,000 men, and there's only two swords. I guess all the rest of them got some kind of farming implement to try to defend themselves or go to war with. It's a sad commentary, I think, on the people of God when they get reduced to that state. But now, keep in mind what's happened now is that Saul is being hard-pressed. He had 3,000 men, and now they're all deserting because they see the Philistines. I mean, their armies are just massive. And so Saul's left with an army of 600 men left. And this is where this episode begins in this chapter 14, which really God will turn the situation around through his son Jonathan. It begins in verse 1. It says, "Now the day came that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who was carrying his armor, 'Come and let us cross over to the Philistine garrison that is on yonder side.' But he did not tell his father. And Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah under the pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. And the people who were with him were about 600 men." Like I said, his army's been really reduced because so many people have just been, deserting, going AWOL, turning and running before the battle because they see the whole situation is absolutely hopeless. And in verse 3 it says, "And Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the priest of the Lord at Shiloh, was wearing an ephod, and the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. And between the passes by which Jonathan sought to cross over to the Philistine garrison, there was a sharp crag on the one side and a sharp crag on the other side. And the name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other was Sine. And one crag rose on the north opposite Michmash, and the other on the south opposite Geba. Then Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, says, 'Come and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few.' And his armor bearer said to him, 'Do all that is in your heart. Turn yourself and here I am with you according to your desire. Then Jonathan said, behold, we will cross over to the men and reveal ourselves to them. If they say to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand in our place and not go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hands, and thus shall be the sign to us. And when both of them revealed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines said, behold, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves. So the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us, and we will tell you something. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hands of Israel. Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, and with his armor bearer behind him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer put some to death after him. And that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about a half a furrow of an acre of land. And there was a trembling in the camp in the field and among all the peoples, and even the garrison and the raiders trembled, and the earthquake, so that it became a great trembling. Now, before we go any further, God's people are totally outnumbered, and it's physically impossible for them to be able to win this battle because they're just so greatly disadvantaged in every way, all right? But look at Jonathan's faith, and I think it says a lot, because here Jonathan is, and he doesn't tell his father where he's going, but they got this whole army that's kind of get this picture of what's happening here. There's two cliffs, basically. On one side of the cliff is all of Israel's army, and on the other side of the cliff is all the Philistines' army, and there's this crag or this chasm, you know, that's separating the two of them. Well, apparently Jonathan and his armor bearer said, well, let's just go down the cliff, then we'll climb up the other side and see if God will give them into our hands. Now, this is kind of interesting, because when they go to the other side, he says this in verse 6. He says, Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, says, come up and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us. For the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few. Now, what he says there is absolutely true. I mean, Saul was looking at his situation, and he was panicking. Remember when we read a couple of chapters back, it was like Samuel gave him specific instructions. He said, look, wait till I get there before the battle. Wait 7 days, all right, and wait till I get there. And when I get there and I offer the sacrifice to God, then I'm going to tell you what to do. Well, on the seventh day, Saul, he was just getting antsy, man. He was panicking because all of his men were deserting him, and Samuel hadn't showed up yet. So he just presumed upon the office of the priesthood, and he offered up this sacrifice to God, where if he just had waited just a little bit longer in obedience, God would have tremendously blessed him. But because he disobeyed, Samuel said to him that God's going to tear the kingdom from your hands, from you, because you didn't obey. You see, because his disobedience showed a lack of faith. If you remember when we were reading about the episode when Samuel first met Saul, Samuel told Saul just a number of different things that would happen to him in the course of one day. And everything happened in the precise manner in which Samuel, predicted. And so in a sense, you can almost see that, hey, if Saul was really a man of faith, he would have said, you know what, everything Samuel has told me in the past, it has come to pass exactly the way he foretold it, that this guy's a man of God, so I can rest in him. Just wait for his word. Wait for what he has to say to me. But he looks at his situation, and what happens? This is what can happen to any of us. It can happen to the best of us. I look at the world we live in, and believe me, it is difficult. I think everybody's just almost stressed to the max because we're under the gun. There's so much pressure everywhere we turn. There's just we're basically up to our eyeballs in obligations and responsibilities and deadlines and duties. And you know what I'm talking about? I mean, this is the situation that we're in. You kind of look at the situation and you feel like, man, we really do need to just look to God, wait upon God, I mean, and look to him in his word. And here Saul is in a very stressful situation, but he couldn't wait. He just, felt like, I got to do something. And I think that's what happens to a lot of people when they're under the gun. They feel pressure. They feel stress. Rather than being still and know that God is God, they feel like they got to get in the ball. They got to get in the act. They got to start pushing and shoving and forcing and trying to make things work, just like Saul did. But here's the thing. If he would have just waited Samuel would have got there, offered a sacrifice, and then he would have told them how he was going to achieve the victory. And here's the thing. Saul was looking at his circumstances, and I'm telling you, it's hard for me not to look at my circumstances sometimes, especially with my wife's illness. But here's what we've got to keep in mind. Remember Peter, when he's walking upon the water to go out to Jesus, he was doing fine until he did what?
Took his eyes off Jesus.
When, waves. Yeah, it's waves. Like when he had his focus on Christ, he had no problem walking on the water. But then he gets his focus off of Christ, and he's looking at the waves and the feeling the wind, and everything just looks so overwhelming. What happened to him? And he just goes right, heads right for the bottom, and he screams out the shortest prayer in the Bible, "Lord, help me." And Jesus grabbed his arm and pulled him up. And he said, "Man, you know, where's your faith?" It's like we can lose our faith when we look at our circumstances rather than looking to Christ. And that's what happened to Saul. Rather than looking at God, he was looking at his circumstances, and there, and it just led him to just sin, because he ended up presuming upon the priesthood. But here, we got a situation where we can see that, hey, God's not limited. He's not restrained. With that verse 6, he's not restrained by many or by few. And as the story begins to unfold, we're going to see that, hey, God had a plan all along if Saul would have just waited. And what we need to do is just be still and obey. That's what he should have done. I think that's one of the primary messages. But now, here's a situation where Jonathan says to his honor bearer, look, let's go up here. And he presents a situation where he just simply says, hey, listen, we'll show ourselves to the Philistines. And this is a garrison. This is an outpost that's, situated that's not the main camp of the Philistine army, but it's just an outpost there. So they said, we'll show ourselves to them. And if they tell us to stay where we're at, then we'll just take it as we're not to engage them in fighting. But if they say, come up here, then we'll take it as a sign from the Lord that he's given them into our hands. Now, I don't believe that Jonathan in any way here is tempting God. Because remember, you go back to the 17th chapter of the book of Exodus, where the people tempted God, saying, is God with us or not, when they weren't getting what they wanted as far as water and stuff like that. In other words, they're saying God needs to prove himself. Well, we were told in Deuteronomy that, I think it's Deuteronomy 6, that we are not to tempt the Lord thy God. All right? That's a sin. As a matter of fact, Jesus himself quoted that to Satan when Satan was tempted him after 40 days in the wilderness, when Satan took him upon the high pinnacle of the temple and says, if you're really the Son of God, cast yourself down, because it is written in the Psalms that he will give his angels charge over you, lest you dash your foot against a stone. And here the devil is quoting scripture where Jesus quotes Deuteronomy 6 right back at him and says, hey, it is also written, you know, thou shalt not tempt the Lord your God. So we don't want to get in a situation where we tempt God, and I don't believe that Jonathan is tempting God here. But what I think he's doing is he's looking for an indication from God whether he should do this or not. And I think that's what we need to do. Because I live by this scripture. I live by this scripture verse, Proverbs 3:5. It says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your path. That's a scripture verse I think everybody ought to live by. Don't go by our own reasoning. So what happens is they show themselves, they reveal themselves to the Philistines, and the Philistines say, well, come up here. You know, so they're at a real disadvantage. I mean, they're climbing up this cliff to get to their enemies. I mean, they talk about a disadvantage, but I guess this outpost of Philistines just figured, hey, these guys are going to be just a pushover. All right? But what happens is that, reading that latter part of verse 12, it says, come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hands of Israel. Jonathan's talking to his armor bearer. And verse 13 says, and Jonathan climbed on his hands and his feet with his armor bearer behind him, and they fell before Jonathan and his armor bearer and put some of them to death after him. And that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men and about a half a furlough in an acre of land. So in other words, we're about a 40-yard span, he ended up killing over 20 men. And this is what's going to ignite a whole panic in the army, because he says here in that verse 15, and there was a trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the peoples, even the garrison and the raiders trembled, and the earth quaked so that it became a great trembling. Now Saul's watchmen in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, a multitude melted away, and they were here and there. And Saul said to the people who were with him, number now and see who has gone from us. And when they had numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. And Saul said to Ahijah, bring the ark of God here, for the ark of God was at that time with the sons of Israel. And so it happened while Saul talked to the priest that the commotion in the camp of the Philistines continued and increased. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand. Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and came to the battle, and behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was a very great confusion. Now the Hebrews who were with the Philistines previously, who went up with them all around in the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. And all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines had fled. Even they also pursued them closely in the battle. So the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth Aven. Now the men of Israel were hard-pressed on that day, for Saul had put the people under an oath, saying, cursed be the man who eats food before evening, and until I have avenged myself on my enemies. So none of the people tasted food, and all the people of the land entered the forest, and there was a honey on the ground. And when the people entered the forest, behold, there was a flow of honey, but no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard when his father put the people under the oath. Therefore he put out the end of his staff that was in his hand, and he dipped it into the honeycomb, and put his hand into his mouth, and his eyes brightened. And then one of the people answered and said, your father strictly put the people under an oath, saying, cursed be the man who eats food today. And the people were weary. Then Jonathan said, my father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I have tasted a little of this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoils of their enemies which they found? For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great. And they struck among the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon. And the people were very weary. And the people rushed greedily upon the spoils, and took sheep and oxen and calves, and slew them on the ground. And all the people ate them with the blood. And then they told Saul, saying, behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood. And he said, you have acted treacherously. Roll up a great stone to me today. And Saul said, disperse yourselves among the people, and say to them, each one of you, bring me his ox or his sheep, and slaughter it here and eat. And do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood. So all of the people that night brought each one his ox with him, and they slaughtered it there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord, and it was the first altar that he built to the Lord. And then Saul said, let us go down after the Philistines by night and take spoil among them until morning light, and let us not leave a man of them. And they said, do whatever seems good to you. So the priest said, let us draw near to God here. And Saul inquired of God, shall we go down after the Philistines? Wilt thou give them into the hand of Israel? But he did not answer him on that day. And Saul said, draw near here, all of your chiefs and the people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today. For as the Lord lives who delivers Israel, though it is in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. But not one of all the people answered him. And he said to all of Israel, you shall be on one side, and I and Jonathan and my son will be on the other side. And the people said to Saul, do what seems good to you. Therefore Saul said to the Lord, the God of Israel, give a perfect lot. And Jonathan and Saul were taken, and the people escaped. And Saul said, cast lots between me and Jonathan my son. And Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. So Jonathan told him and said, indeed, I tasted a little honey with the end of my staff that was in my hand. Here I am, I must die. And Saul said, may God do this to me and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. But the people said to Saul, must Jonathan die, who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Now listen, I just want the reason I read that far is because you had to get the whole gist of the story, because I think it's really, really instructive. At least it is to me in a lot of ways. But first of all, okay, now God's beginning to work, and he's working because Jonathan showed this tremendous faith. And what does God do? Once Jonathan gets up there with his armor bearer and he kills about 20 men, then God causes an earthquake. And in the earthquake, the Philistines are just thrown into total confusion, because by now they know that some kind of conflict has taken place in terms of this garrison that's been attacked by Jonathan and his armor bearer. And And when in the midst of this earthquake, they just feel like they probably are feeling like a whole huge, battlement regiment, just the army's coming at them on every side, and the ground's just shaking, and they're coming from every direction, and God throws them in such confusion that they start killing each other off. You see, God is not limited by numbers. I mean, that's just it. We just got to get it through our thick skulls. What he looks for, he says it in Chronicles, that, hey, the eyes of the Lord go to and fro upon the face of the earth to see whose heart is totally committed to him that he may strongly support. And you see a situation in Jonathan. He put his total trust and confidence in God. God gave him a tremendous victory and kicked off, just defeated the Philistines. But now, what's interesting to me is this. Look at Saul. I mean, Saul had so much potential, but look at the way the guy ends up doing one stupid, foolish thing after another, because he didn't wait upon the Lord when it came to Samuel. So now, when the Philistine army is in total confusion, he's having the priest pray. But the more that Saul hears the Philistine army in this total state of confusion, and I guess they're being routed by God himself, what does Saul do? Look at that verse 19. And it happened while Saul talked to the priest that the commotion of the camp of the Philistines continued and increased. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand. Now, what does that mean? Here's the priest. He's praying to God on behalf of Israel. He's interceding on their behalf for victory. And so when Saul says, withdraw your hand, what he's saying is, okay, shut up or quit praying. All right? That's enough prayer. He just cuts him short because he feels like, hey, we got to get out there. We don't got time for praying here. That's what he's saying. When he says, withdraw your hand, here it is, the priest is interceding on behalf of Israel to get this victory. And he says, withdraw your hand. Now, that was the big mistake. Big mistake. Because here it is, the priest is interceding on behalf of God's people for their victory. But what happens in the middle of his prayer? Saul cuts it short. He really should have waited. See, the guy is very, very impulsive. Because what happens when he didn't wait for the priest to finish his prayer? Instead, he comes out and makes this stupid, ridiculous, asinine, rash oath or a curse. See, this is why the Bible says, first of all, it says pray without ceasing. But of course, there's a time for everything, including when you need to quit praying and start to act. God even said that to Moses at one time. You know, it's time to get off this mountain and get going. Or he said to, in the middle of Joshua's praying, he says, get up off your face. You know, quit praying. It's time to act. So there is a time when you got to, you know, you can't just sit around and pray all the time. You got to act on your praying. But you got to wait for God's timing. And when he just said, withdraw your hand to the priest, he just said, basically, quit praying. We're going. That was a mistake. Because what did he do? He ended up pronouncing this curse. And what did he do with this curse? He said, hey man, and under his curse, he just said, if anybody eats anything today before the sun goes down, he's going to be under his curse, basically meaning that he's going to be executed. So what has Saul done? He's elevated his own command to be equal with God's. I don't know if you know where I'm going with this, but you see, this can happen many times even within the church. All right, God has told us specifically what to do and what not to do. But look what men do when it comes to God's commands, is they will elevate their own. And, you know, I don't want to get off on tangent, but I thought it was kind of interesting. I was just reading this today. This is the latest issue of Newsweek magazine. And in it, you know, they have a little word, a little brief article called Belief Watch. And in it, they're talking about Robert Kennedy, who, of course, was assassinated, and his wife, Ethel, how they brought up their kids and you know, the Catholic faith. And the oldest daughter, Kathleen, I guess she's written a book, but this is what she says. And so she suggests reforms that she believes will revitalize her beloved Catholic Church and refocus the faithful on service. Says the hierarchy in Rome, she says, needs to stop obsessing about sex. It needs to rethink its position on the ordination of women and married people, on abortion, and on gay clergy, and gay unions. we always end up making, I think, a grave mistake when we begin to elevate the commandments of men either over the commandments of God or to be equal with the commandments of God. And that's why I read this article here, this little bit of an article, where here's a woman who's basically saying, well, the church needs to quit obsessing about things like abortion and like gay union and homosexual activity. And what she's saying, well, she's completely dismissing out of hand what God has clearly said. And now she's elevating her own form of quote-unquote religion to be superior to what God has said. And, that, you know, like I'm saying, it happens all the time, all over the board, all over the turf, and we get ourselves in a real, I think, we paint ourselves in a corner, just like Saul did. He puts everybody in a curse, and look what happens. It becomes self-defeating, because if he had allowed his men to eat, they would have had the strength to carry this battle right up to the very end. All right, but what happens is that now it really trips up the people, because now, because of his man-made commandment, what happens to the people? They become famished, and then as they become famished, what happens after the battle? They end up, they don't even wait to properly prepare their food. They start eating their food with the blood in it, and that was strictly forbidden by God. That was an abomination to God, because, you know, he said very clearly that people were not to eat anything with the blood in it, or to eat blood, because blood, it says very clearly that the life of every living creature is in the blood. And by pouring out the blood of an animal that you're about to eat, it shows very graphically that you recognize that God has dominion over all of life. But to eat the blood, it would be basically sacrilegious, showing that, you know, total disregard for God being the one that's sovereign over all of living creatures. And here you got a situation where, because of one man elevated his command to be equal with God or superior to God, then ends up causing the people to sin against God. And, you know, it can happen. It happens time and time again. That's why I just constantly feel like, hey, man, it is a dangerous road to go down when people, you know, I don't care how well-meaning they may be initially, when they begin to elevate their teaching to be equal with that of God's. It's just, you know, we've got to say, okay, this is what God said on the subject. Let's not add to it, and definitely let's not take away from it, all right? Let's just do what God has said, and then we won't run into these problems, you know what I'm saying? But here's what happened to these people. They end up sinning against God because of this guy's command, all right? But now, Saul's beginning to wonder, well, the sun's going down, but maybe we should continue to pursue these guys. So he wanted to ask the priest, so should we do it? But God's not giving him an answer, all right? So he figured, well, we must not be getting an answer because somebody has violated my command. And so he says, why don't me and my Jonathan stay here? I stand on this side, all you people stand on the other side, and cast lots and see who had violated my command. And so, you know, it comes down to him and Jonathan, and then lots cast between him and Jonathan, and then it's Jonathan. And then Jonathan said, well, you know, what happened was I didn't hear the command, and I ate some honey. Here I am, I must die. You see what happens? You see what happens when men begin to elevate their own teaching, their own man-made commandments to be either equal or superior to God's? It just makes a complete mess of everything, doesn't it? But now, I think what's kind of significant is God, you know, the people saved Jonathan out of, you know, because Saul, you know, this guy is really pretty darn impulsive, isn't he? Pretty rash or pretty, I don't know. He doesn't show a lot of wisdom and common sense because he's willing to put his own son to death for violating his command. But what his command has done is basically prevented him from a greater victory that he could have had, and it became a stumbling block to his own people when they began to disobey God. But the people end up saving Jonathan by, you know, absolutely refusing to have anything to do with it. I'm sure probably Saul was relieved by then, but still, what happened there? And I really believe the reason he made that stupid, idiotic curse is because he told the priest, withdraw your hand. I mean, we really need to pray. We need about everything. Pray, pray, pray. Prayer is so absolutely essential. Right? Now, like I said, there comes a time when we got to act. But Saul, when he said, withdraw your hand, he basically said, quit praying. We're going. You know, when he should have waited for the priest to finish. That's when he ends up making this ridiculous curse. Anyway, let's pick up where Well, back up that verse 45. But the people said to Saul, must Jonathan die who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Far be it. As the Lord lives, there shall not be one hair on his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. Now see, that they went to their own place. He could have routed them completely and totally, you know, had such a victory that they wouldn't have heard a peep out of him for a long time to come. But because of his rash vow, because of the way that he handled the whole thing, now they got a chance. They go back to their own place, and what are they going to do? They're eventually going to regroup, you know, and it's going to start all over again. Because when you read the life of Saul, what you find out is that he is in constant warfare with the Philistines all the way up to the end of his life. And verse 47 says, now when Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, he fought against all of his enemies on every side, against Moab and the sons of Ammon and Edom and the kings of Zophah and the Philistines. And wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment. And he acted valiantly and defeated the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. Now, you've got to give Saul a lot of credit. I kind of feel bad for the guy because I think he was a good king in many respects. He was a good leader. And he acted out, I think, valiantly in this constant conflict against God's enemies. But the man, you know, I think he made some pretty big mistakes that brought him down. And that's one thing when you are a position of high visibility, when you are a position of leadership. I'm talking spiritual leadership now, but of course you can apply it politically. But I'm talking about this. When you're a position of spiritual leadership, the higher you are, I think the more that's going to be required of you. And the more obedience you're going to have to, I think, exhibit. And unfortunately for Saul, even though he acted valiantly in so many different ways, the various episodes in his life where he flat out disobeyed God brought him down and brought his ministry down, or basically brought his dynasty down. And at verse 48 says, and he acted valiantly and defeated the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. Verse 49 says, now the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ishvi and Malchishua. And the names of his two daughters were these. The names of the firstborn was Merab, and the name of the younger was Michal. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the captain of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. And Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul, and when Saul saw any mighty man, or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff, or basically drafted him into his army. Anybody have anyone to add or share to that episode? Well, listen, let's just quickly go through this chapter 15, and then we'll close tonight, because it says in verse 1 of chapter 15, it says, then Samuel said to Saul, the Lord sent me to anoint you as a king over his people, over Israel. Now, therefore, listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has, and do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman and child and infant and ox and sheep and camel and donkey. Then Saul summoned the people and numbered them at Telaim, the 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. And Saul came to the city of Amalek and set an ambush in the valley. And Saul said to the Kenites, go, depart, go down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the sons of Israel when they came up from Egypt. So the Kenites departed among the Amalekites. So Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as far as you go to Sur, which is east of Egypt. And he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the oxen and the fatlings and the lambs and all that was good. They were not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything despised and worthless that they utterly destroyed. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel, saying, I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me and has not carried out my commandments. And Samuel was distressed and cried out to the Lord all night. And Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul. And it was told Samuel, saying, Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up a monument for himself, then turned and proceeded down to go to Gilgal. And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, Blessed are you of the Lord. I have carried out the command of the Lord. But Samuel said, What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of oxen which I hear? And Saul said, They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God. But the rest we have utterly destroyed. And then Samuel said to Saul, Wait, and let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And he said to him, Speak. And Samuel said, Is it not true that though you were little in your own eyes, and you were made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are exterminated? Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rushed upon the spoil and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord? Then Saul said to Samuel, I did obey the voice of the Lord and went on the mission which the Lord sent me, and have brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took some of the spoil and the sheep and the oxen and the choicest of the things devoted to destruction to sacrifice to the Lord, the God of Gilgal. And Samuel said, Has the Lord has much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as a sin of divination, and insubordination as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. Then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned. I have indeed transgressed the commandment of the Lord, and your words, because I feared the people and listened to their voice. Now therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me, that I may worship the Lord. But Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. And Samuel turned to go, and Saul seized the edge of his robe, and it tore. So Samuel said to him, The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today, and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. And also the glory of Israel will not lie, nor change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. And then he said, I have sinned, but please honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel, and go back with me that I may worship the Lord your God. So Samuel went back following Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. Then Samuel said, Bring me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And Agag came to him cheerfully. And Agag said, Surely the bitterness of death has passed. But Samuel said, As your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. And Samuel hewed Agag to pieces before the Lord at Gilgal. Then Samuel went to Ramah, but Saul went up to his house in Gibeah of Saul. And Samuel did not see Saul again until the day of his death. For Samuel grieved over Saul, and the Lord regretted that he made Saul king over Israel. Now, you know, that was 35 verses, but I had to read the whole thing, because you got to keep this whole thing in context, okay? And just, I think there's a lot of instruction here, you know, but I'm not going to, you know, belabor a lot of it, but just simply keep this in mind. You know, you go all the way back to the time of Moses during the Exodus, when the people were following God in a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day, and they were following on the march in the desert. And what happened was the Amalekites, and now keep this in mind. Anybody know where Amalek came from? Amalek was the grandson of Esau. Now, in a sense, they're related to God's people, aren't they? Because Jacob and Esau were twin brothers, right? And so through Jacob came Israel, or through Jacob, Abraham's descendants came. But then also through Esau, you see Amalek come on the scene. Now, here's what's interesting. The people are going through the desert, and what's happened is the stragglers, the, you know, the lame or the weak or the old or the infirm, or people who just couldn't keep up with the march, they were basically, you know, straggling behind, taking up the rear as far as the march was concerned. And God wasn't, you know, setting any track record here. I mean, he was just going slow, but some people just couldn't keep up with the march. And what happened was that Amalek began to ambush the stragglers, and they began to kill them and to run off with their spoils. He showed absolutely no fear of God. But then what happens? Joshua goes out there with an army to fight Amalek. And in the midst of this fighting Amalek, every time that Moses had his arms raised to heaven praying for the victory over Amalek, as long as he had his hands up there praying, Joshua and his army would be winning the battle. But Moses' arms would get so exhausted from having him, you know, stressed out before God, that they would fall to the ground just at a pure human limitations. And so what happens, they, and Aaron took a big stone, and they had Moses sit on upon it, and they both, Ur and Aaron, held up both of his hands, and that way they got victory over Amalek. Now, I've said this before when we've gone through other portions of Scripture. Who does Amalek represent spiritually, symbolically? What does Amalek represent? Okay, well, what it really represents is our flesh. Amalek represents our fallen nature. All right, and God said that there will be perpetual war between Israel and Amalek. Meaning this, when I talk about our fallen nature, if you want to give it a different name, you can call it Amalek, because that is the flesh. The flesh is always going to war against the spirit. It's always going to be at conflict with the spirit. That's what we're told in Romans. Paul says, the flesh wars against the spirit against the flesh. In other words, our flesh wants to do what it wants to do, while God wants us to do what he wants us to do. That's why Jesus said, hey man, you can't be my disciple unless you deny yourself. Deny Amalek. Deny yourself. Pick up your cross daily and follow me. That's what it takes, right? And you see Saul here, even though he's fighting Amalek, literally, what's happening is that, spiritually speaking, Amalek is getting the better of him because he's constantly giving in to his fleshly desires. And here's a classic example of it. Now, here's another interesting thing. The people have been in the land for 400 years now. It's been 400 years since Amalek attacked Israel in the desert. But 400 years later, the descendants of Amalek are still very much alive. And what does God say? He tells Samuel, go destroy this wicked nation, these wicked people. Now, you would think after 400 years that God would have long forgot, right? He long forgot. But no, he's going to bring judgment now. This is why when you read in Ephesians, you read in Corinthians, and you read in Galatians about the deeds of the flesh, people may think that they're getting away with sinning today, but God doesn't forget. Like I said, I mean, right now we're pushing having murdered over 40, almost 50 million unborn children, and it seems like God is totally indifferent. But I guarantee you, there's coming a day of reckoning, just like it was for Amalek. I'm telling you, there's coming a day of judgment for this horrendous sin that this nation has committed against these defenseless human beings. It's just going to happen. All right, like just like Amalek coming upon the defenseless people on the march, so many defenseless human beings have been murdered in this country, and believe me, God hasn't forgotten. Because here, 400 years later, God gives the decree, I want Saul to go forth with his army and utterly destroy these people. Okay, it's payback time. Now they're going to be destroyed. Now, to the fuzzy thinker, to the shallow thinker, to the narrow-minded person, they're going to look at this and say, well, God's a big bully, and this doesn't make sense because it doesn't seem right to execute these women and children and so on and so forth. But I'm telling you, God would never issue such a command or such a decree if Amalek was living for God. But instead, you see another situation where God judges wickedness and wicked people. And even, unfortunately, the children die in this judgment. The children don't go to hell, obviously, but they end up dying in this judgment. And that's what's going to happen. A lot of innocent people are going to die when the judgment starts falling on this nation because of our gross sins. But just in tying this up or winding it down, because I know we're almost out of time, here's a situation where, what does Saul do? He only shows half obedience, because what does he do? He's been given specific instruction. You're going to kill every man, woman, and child. And what else were they to kill? Every single, you know, living creature. The spoils were to be destroyed. But he says, Saul says here that the people pressured him, okay, to keep the best of the spoils. And that, what was the rationalization?
You wanted to save some of the best to sacrifice to your God, Samuel.
Right. In other words, hey, let's save some of this. We can always sacrifice to God. Because they know if we save the best, we can give part of it to God. Right. And then we're going to be able to keep the rest. Right. So you see how easy it is to rationalize disobedience? It's so easy. Because why? We're told in Jeremiah 17, the heart's deceitful above all things. It's desperately wicked. Nobody can know the true inner motives of the heart but God. I mean, we can plead the purity of anything. But God gave them specific instructions. But look at Saul. Here's an example. All right. When Saul said, nobody better touch any food at all, oh, he's going to be executed. That was a man-made command, right? And he stuck to that command so tightly that he was willing to execute his own son. But now, look what happens. They are told to execute all the animals, but then the people pressure him not to do it, and he concedes to them. He was willing to kill his own son, but he's not willing to kill the spoils or the animals. You see what I'm saying? This is what happens when we end up putting our own man-made commandments above God's commandments, or to be equal with God's commandments. Nothing's changed. I mean, when Christ was on the scene, he accused the Pharisees of doing exactly the same thing. Exactly the same thing. They were nullifying the commandments of God by issuing in their own commandments. But the interesting thing here is that Saul says to Samuel, well, I did obey the voice of the Lord. But his obedience was only partial obedience. And that's the thing. We can't just obey God with half measures. We can't just obey him partially. When God gives a command, thou shalt not commit adultery, we can't say to yourself, well, you know, I just do it once in a while. What does that mean? That's only partial obedience. We got to obey him when he's made himself so clear. All right, this is what's so easy for us to do. Justify anything. Anyway, you see a situation here in closing thought. What does Samuel say to him? And I think this is pretty darn insightful, because in that verse 22, Samuel responds to Saul by saying, has the Lord much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Obedience is everything. This is what Jesus said. He said in, I think it's the 14th chapter of the Gospel of John, he says, hey, these people over here who say they love me, but they don't obey me, they don't love me. He says, these people over here who obey me, they love me. That's the acid test. That's the litmus test. Obedience. He says, behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams, to do what we're told. In other words, for rebellion is the sin of divination. Or literally, does anybody's Bible say witchcraft? All right? Really, that's what it means. For rebellion, this is a sin of witchcraft. You know what that means? I mean, if we get ourselves into sin where we are rebelling against God and we continue to engage in that sin, we actually put ourselves under the influence of the powers of darkness. And people can end up literally being possessed through their rebellion. Because it says here, rebellion is a sin of divination. Is the sin of witchcraft? I mean, you get into witchcraft, you open yourself up to what? Demonic possession. And same thing with rebellion. People who want to engage in some immoral lifestyles and continue to go down that road, I'm not saying they're all possessed by any means, but most of them probably aren't, but they do open themselves up to demonic influence and sometimes to demonic possession. Anybody have anything want to add or share to what we read tonight? Because I think it is pretty darn insightful. As far as learning from the failures of Saul. Anyway,
well, I have a question. Because, I mean, I'm at a part of my life where I don't want to jump in and get married again. And I really, really feel like I love someone, but I'm not going to just go get married. I don't know how to say this.
Go ahead. You can open up now.
So in other words, you're saying if I engage in fornication because I want to put off marriage, is that okay? Or does that open me up to possession or whatever?
Yeah.
I'm saying this, all right? We're told very clearly. That's a good question. It's a legitimate question because let's just put it this way. We're told in Thessalonians, it says, this is the will of God, that you abstain from fornication. Fornication is premarital sex. Now that says this is the will of God. Now understand, God understands our frame. You know, it's so easy for us to fall into sin, all right? It's just very easy. But here's the thing. We have to call an ace and a spade. If we, through human weakness, fall into this sin, what we really need to do is pick ourselves up and confess our sin and forsake our sin. Even if we fall into the same sin over and over and over again, as long as we're intellectually honest with God and ourselves and say, you know what, I blew it again, Lord, forgive me for this. You know, with your grace, I'm determined to live in obedience to you. And then you pick yourself up and keep going. And you're being sincere with God, all right? Then you're not in rebellion. Mm-hmm. But rebellion comes in where it's just a defiance, where you're just going to do your own will, regardless of what God has said, and not acknowledge your sin. Saul wouldn't acknowledge his sin here, all right? Until he's just forced to. But he's not going to acknowledge it. He's going to justify it and rationalize it and excuse it. And so that's something we can't do. We have to just obey God. And one last concluding thought. That verse 33, but Samuel said, as your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. He's talking to Agag here, who it says in that verse 32, I think it's significant, because Samuel says, bring me Agag and the king of the Amalekites. And Agag came to him cheerfully. And Agag said, surely the bitterness of death has passed me. Meaning, Saul spared the king, all right, probably as a trophy, right, when he was supposed to have killed him. But then, now Samuel's going to finish the job. Samuel's going to do what Saul failed to do. And what was that? It was to execute this wicked man, all right? But what did this wicked man say? He figured, well, the worst is past. Now they're going to let me go free. Well, what happened? God's prophet yooned him to death. And here's the thing. People can feel like, hey, they've just escaped God's judgments. And then somehow they're going to get away with it. But they're not going to get away with it. One way, shape, or form, all right, wickedness is going to be dealt with and wicked people are going to be judged. They're just not going to get away with it because the Bible makes it abundantly clear that, hey, be not deceived. God is not mocked. The man is going to reap exactly what it is. So you can't just live your life in wanton disregard for God's laws and commandments and trample them under your foot and live a wicked life and think that, hey, man, I'm not going to reap the whirlwind. You know, everything's going to come up roses for me. Because it may appear like that way, that you can get away with everything and anything, but in the end, what happens? God is going to execute judgment on the wicked. Anybody have anyone to add or share?